The last speaker of today is Agnese Bissi, and she will talk about large spin systematics in CFT.
Let me start by thanking the organizer for giving me the opportunity to speak here in this very nice conference. I'm enjoying it a lot and I learned many things. So what I'm going to discuss today is large spin systematic in conformal field theories, and most of my talk is based on this paper here that I wrote in collaboration with Fernando Aldaez and Tomek Lukowski, who is in the audience here. So we heard many talks about N equal 4 super Young Mills in this conference, and indeed N equal 4 super Young Mills is a conformal field theory, is a conformal theory. And what I'm going to discuss in this talk is a way of studying some properties of conformal field theories. So not only supersymmetric conformal field theories, but general conformal field theories. And you won't see Feynman diagrams, so it's a kind of different way of studying conformal field theories. And the way in which conformal field theories are studied by using this method is by studying some symmetries or some consistency relations that constrains the CFT data. So this consistency relation comes by studying the consistency of higher point correlation functions and, for instance, crossing symmetry and unitarity and the structure of the operator product expansion. I don't want to spend a lot of time discussing these things because we will go through all the steps. But more specifically, what I'm going to discuss is how to study analytically the structure of the dimension and the operator product coefficients of operators with spin. And all these things I will do in the limit of large spin. So I want to study this, the dimension and the operator product expansion coefficient in the large spin limit. So now you can ask, why do you want to study these operators? Why these operators are interesting? Let me start on reverse order on what I wrote. So the first motivation that we already listened in Amit's talk is the fact that they play an important role in the DSCFT correspondence and mostly in the integrability. So these operators that I'm going to discuss are exactly the one that Amit introduced. So you have a bunch of derivatives, a long operator with a lot of derivatives. These are precisely my operator in the limit of large spin, which is exactly the same limit that I'm going to discuss. Another thing why these operators are interesting is that they appear also in deep anelastic scattering process in QCD. So if we move a bit from conformal field theories, we can such operator appear in this context. Another thing is that the anomalous dimension of this operator in the limit of large spin is controlled by what is called cusp anomalous dimension that I will define in a couple of slides. And this object, as we heard in many talks, controls IR singularity of scattering amplitudes and UV singularities of Wilson loop with cusps. So this is why these operators are kind of interesting and they play an important role in conformal field theories. Now, let me be a bit more specific. Let me consider an operator of this form. So let's say that I'm considering an operator which is made of scalar fields and derivatives. So if we study the dimension of this operator, the dimension of this operator can be written in this form for large spin. So L in my talk is the spin. So you can see that the dimension minus the spin, which is what usually is called twist, it can be written in this form as a function, which is what I already introduced, which is the cusp anomalous dimension, time log L. So you see that at large L, the dimension, the twist of this operator just goes as log L times a function, which is a function of the coupling constant. So G is the coupling constant of the theory, so I'm assuming for the moment that my theory is perturbative, so it has a coupling and it emits a perturbative expansion, and this cusp anomalous dimension is it depends only on the coupling constant, And this expression, this form, so where you have log L times this function, is valid at any loop order. This has been shown in this paper some years ago, and more recently it has been derived with the same symmetry arguments that I'm going to discuss today. So, actually, the aim of my talk is to explain what are these dots here. So what happens to the subleading terms in this expansion? So, of course, this is the leading guy, but what can we say about subleading corrections? So before going to the juice of my talk, let me remind you what is reciprocity. So imagine that we take an operator, some consider operators of twist 2. As I said, the twist is just a dimension minus the spin. So since we are in perturbation theory, of course this operator will acquire an anomalous dimension. So we can write the dimension minus the spin as 2, which is, as I said, the twist, plus the anomalous dimension. Now we can introduce a function. I can define a function f in this way. So I can say that this anomalous dimension can be written as a function of L plus 1/2 gamma L. So this is just a definition. And then I say that reciprocity is the statement that this function L can be expanded in this form only with even power of this JB, which is the Casimir of the collinear group, which can be written, which is just L times L plus 1. So this is a property which has been first observed in QCD, and then it has also been checked for other theories, conformal field theories, and also supersymmetric conformal field theories in a series of papers. And actually, this property has been used also to constrain, really, the structure of the anomalous dimension. Now let me say what's really the aim of my talk. The aim of my talk is to prove the reciprocity principle using this approach based on symmetries of the theory. And we will see actually that this approach is valid perturbatively, namely for the operators that I discussed the one slide ago, at any loop order, and non perturbatively. And also we will see that by using this approach, we also find another reciprocity principle for operator product expansion coefficient. So we will see how this proof goes. So let me start by reminding some very, very simple thing that maybe you will be bored, but just to set a bit the notation. So if we consider the conformal group contains a translation with generators P mu, Lorentz transformation with generators M mu nu, scale transformation, and a special conformal transformation. So the algebra looks more or less in this form. So these are just some commutators. So we see that D with K mu just gives K mu with a minus sign. D with P mu gives just P mu. So we will see why these two commutation relations are important, but for the moment let's keep it as it is. Now we can also ask what happens to a field under conformal transformation. So if we see the commutation relation between M and phi at position zero, we can define in this way the spin. So we can see that this is a matrix M mu nu that acts on this field phi. Then we can also define a dimension. And then we can label our operator with two numbers. One is the spin and one is the dimension of the field. Then, as we can observe from the algebra, we can also define some fields which are primary and are the fields which are annihilated by special conformal transformation. So there is a class of fields annihilated by special conformal transformation at position zero, and these are what are called primary fields. Now, if we start acting with P mu on these primary fields, we get a tower of fields which are called descendants. So we have our primary, then we keep acting with P mu, and we obtain all the descendants related to the primary. Now, the operators form an algebra, which is called operator product expansion in general. So what this means? This means that we can define a product of two fields. So we have a field phi I, a field of phi j, and this product can be expressed as a sum over all the primaries and all the descendants appearing in this product through this formula here. I will call this guy OP coefficient, 3-point function, structure constant, but it's always this number here. So this is actually is peculiar to conformal field theories, and we will see why I can call this number in these ways. Now, as you all of you knows, all the information of a conformal field theory is encoded in a set of numbers, so in the set of dimension and the structure constants of local operators. And then how can we see that? So we see that conformal symmetry fixes the space-time dependence of 2- and 3-point correlation function. For instance, what I wrote in this slide is 2- and 3-point function of scalar operator, primary scalar operator. So if you take a couple of primaries and you normalize it properly, what you get is a delta function and x to the 2 delta, where delta is the dimension of this field. So from the 2-point function, we know this dimension. We can read off this dimension. From 3-point function, we can do more or less the same thing, but as you can see, conformal symmetry fixes everything for us up to a coefficient. So all the 3-point functions are determined up to a coefficient. So in general, if we know all this dimension and all this coefficient, we can use the operator product expansion and compute in general all the higher points correlation function. Notice that this C1 to 3 is exactly the same number that appear in the operator product expansion in this formula here. So this is just the same number. Now the first non-trivial correlation function is the 4-point function. So if we take the 4-point function of 4 identical scalar operators, so I'm this guy here, this can be written as a function of UMV, where UMV are the conformal cross ratios, times this factor here, which depends on the dimension of the external operator. Now, what are UNV? UNV are just combination of distances in this way. And, okay, here I just put a comment that if you exchange a pair of points, there are some relations which relate this GUV of UNV with G of V and U. This is just if you exchange in this formula 1 with 3, you can easily see this relation here. But for the moment, what I want to stress from this slide is the fact that we have a 4-point function, and this 4-point function, when we strip off this factor here, is just a function of the cross ratios. Now we are ready to use the operator product expansion, so now we can use the OP in the 4-point function. So imagine that we take the OP of phi at x1 and phi at x2, and the OP of this other guy here. So if you remember a bit the formula that I wrote before, which is actually, I put it also here, so you don't have excuse not to remember. You can apply this formula here, and this is pictorially written here, and in this side. So you can write the GUV, so this 4-point function that I wrote here in the previous slide, in this way. So let's stare a bit to this formula. So one is just the contribution of the identity operator. The identity operator is always present in the operator product expansion of two equal operators. So in this case, we are taking a 4-point function of same operators. So here we get the contribution of identities plus this object here. So let me notice for this slide only one thing. This C square just appears because we have two times. We are applying the OP two times, so we get this coefficient square. And let's see now what are these functions here, G delta L of UMV. Now, this I've already said. L, here, this function is labeled by two numbers, delta and L. So this delta and L denote the spin and the dimension of the intermediate primary. So we have these two operators in the operator product expansion. All the operators present there can be labeled by their spin and their dimension. And this function, G delta L of UV, are what are called conformal blocks. And what these conformal blocks do, they just repack the contribution of all descendants of a given primary. So as I said, in the sum, in the OP, we have primaries and all the tower of descendants. And what this function do, they just, for a given primary, they resum the contribution of all the descendants. Now functions are known only in few cases in closed form, in a closed form, and what I wrote here is the form in four dimensions, meaning space-time dimensions. So this delta, let me be clear, is not to be confused with the delta phi that I wrote at the beginning. So it doesn't have anything to do with the dimension of the external operator. So this is just the dimension of the operators appearing in the operator product expansion. Now, you can see that this function is just a bunch of hypergeometric functions, essentially. So for what you have to remember from this slide are just two things. So this G can be written as U to the 1/2 delta minus L, and this G contains some hypergeometric functions. This is the only thing that you need to remember. Now, what I want to do, I want to study a specific limit of this equation. Namely, I want to study the leading twist operators. So, what I'm going to study are leading twist operators, meaning the operator with smallest twist. Twist, as I said, but I will remind, is the difference between the dimension and the spin. So, how can we study this? So, what I did, I just defined this G in this way. So this is just a definition. G is just U to the 1/2 delta minus L times this function. So if we want to focus on leading twist operator, what we need to do, since U is, this U here, is to the power 1/2 delta minus L, if I want to focus on the small number here, I need to take the small U limit. So if I take the small U limit of this right-hand side, I end up with this expression here, where this, the only thing that is left is this U minus V to the power L and this hypergeometric function here. Then you can see that the power of U is controlled by the twist. So since this is true, it's enough to take the small U limit. Now, if we go to perturbation theory, for instance, as I said, the dimension can be written in this form, and also the four-point function admits a perturbative expansion of this form, so it's U plus 1 plus U, and this is a function which, of course, has to be expanded in non-loop order. So what depends on the loop is this function H as well as this gamma L. And again, one can play the same game. It's enough that you put the proper delta minus L here, and you can write this formula here. This is nothing exotic. Now I want to tell you another thing about conformal blocks. Conformal blocks are the eigenfunction of the conformal Casimir, of the quadratic conformal Casimir. So what we can do, we can construct a conformal Casimir operator for small, in the small U limit, because as I said, we will be interested in the small U limit. So, and in this way, we want an operator, a second order differential operator, as you can see here, that if acting on U delta minus L, this is essentially the conformal block in the small U limit, gives just, this is just an eigenvalue equation. So this is just the eigenvalue of the Casimir operator. And this eigenvalue is just 1 over 4 delta plus L minus 2. Now, what I'm going, the main idea of this talk is the fact that now we can think to the reciprocity principle as an expansion of the anomalous dimension of the three-point function coefficient or OP coefficient as an expansion of the eigenvalue of the full Casimir J square. So as an expansion of this object here, instead of considering the J square B, which was just L plus 2. Now let's see how this goes. Let's start by the simple example. Let's focus at tree level. So we go at tree level. At tree level, we have, of course, that the anomalous dimension is zero, and the three-point function is just a three-point function at tree level, of course. Now we go back to the previous formula that I wrote, and we see that this is just the left-hand side that I wrote some slides ago, and this is just the right-hand side, meaning this is my four-point function at tree level. This is just what you can see from computations at tree level. Now, one can solve for these coefficients here. How do you solve? You just take some limits on the left-hand side, the limit on the right-hand side, and you just obtain a bunch of these three-point functions for different L, and then you either you use mathematics or you just guess, and you obtain the formula for the three-point function at tree level. Now, there is the most important point of my talk, is the fact that if you look at the left-hand side, I show you before what these F are. These are just hypergeometric functions, and you know that these hypergeometric functions have some divergences, and each term on the left-hand side diverges logarithmically as V goes to zero. So on the left-hand side, as V goes to zero, we have a sum of divergent terms on the left-hand side. Now, this infinite sum on the left-hand side has to combine in this way. So the only way in which some logarithmic divergent can combine into something which is of this form is by having an infinite number of these terms. So what I need an infinite number of the on the right-hand side. So this is the only way in which I can achieve this equality here. Now, let me also say this comment. This comment will be clear in the next slide, but I want to just to mention it here. So the large spin behavior of this coefficient here is fixed by the divergence 1 over b. Let's say for a second, and this is just something that I'm inventing it now, but this is not true. I will prove this fact in a couple of slides. Now let me move. This was true at three levels. Let me move to perturbation theory. Perturbation theory, I can introduce a coupling constant, as I said, so everything can be expanded in some coupling constant. So G for me is the coupling constant, and my four-point function can be the four-point function at three level plus G, the four-point function at one loop, and so on. So as I wrote before, this object can be written as 1 plus U, and so again, we are focusing on the leading twist operator, so I only need this power of U in this expansion, 1 plus U, so this is just the four-point function in the small U limit, and a function of log u and v. Of course, this function h now has the full perturbative expansion. Now, again, leading twist intermediate primary have this dimension, so we can rewrite again this thing here. And again, the gamma l now will contain the expansion in the coupling constant. So gamma l now will admit a perturbative expansion. Now, for small v, what do we expect? We expect, again, the same story, because, as I said, again, we will have some hypergeometric function, we will have to sum infinitely number of terms, and now the divergence will come only from the region where L is much bigger than 1. This is because if we consider the sum over L going from 0 to infinity, or the sum over L from some L0, which is different from 0 to infinity, these two sums produces the same singularity. So this means that we can just focus on the tail of this sum. And another point is the fact that the structure, this kind of structure, namely, remember before we had 1 over V plus 1. Now we have 1 over V times a function plus another function. Now, this structure, where there is 1 over v, and then this function depends only on log u and log v, so not on powers of v, this structure is implied at any order in perturbation theory by the analyticity of the three-level result. So, as you can see, the right-hand side depends only on integer powers of v, or, of course, inverse integer powers of v, and this is 1 over v plus 1 plus then it will be the full v, v square, and so on. But we will see that since we are interested in the divergence, we can focus mostly on this term here. Now let me go to my point. So what I want to study, I want to understand how to evaluate this divergence. As I said before, the three-point function takes into account this divergence, and this divergence will come only from the region of large L. Let's see how to see this. So let's let's say that V, I will call this V epsilon, and then expand in powers of epsilon. But expanding in powers of epsilon in this way. So we take L, which is a parameter that I want to send to infinity, as X over square root of epsilon. Now, what I can replace my sum over L by an integral. Now, this integral, of course, is an integral over x. This one half is there because we are only summing over even over even spins, so I just have half of this sum. Now what we can do, we can replace the Mayater geometric function. I can use my the integral representation for the Hapgood geometric function in this way. So essentially what I want to write in a different way the right hand side of the equation before. So I want to express this sum in a different way. The first thing, I need to replace the sum for with an integral. Then I use the integral representation of the Hapgood geometric function in this way by using this rescaling. Then I rescale the OP coefficient in this way, namely I just strip off the three-level result. And then I introduce also the rescaled eigenvalue of the Casimir operator. Remember, what I wanted to do, I wanted to interpret the three-point function and the anomalous dimension as an expansion on this J-square instead of L, essentially. So this is just exactly the same eigenvalue that I showed you before, but with this, this change of coordinates. And again, as I said, we interpret the anomalous dimension in the three-point function in this way, so just as functions of J in this case. And now what we can do, we can integrate. So we can perform the integral that I had before. So we can perform essentially this integral here. And we will obtain this formula here. Let's see what is here. So this is just the elliptic function K, which has this form. Notice that in this case we have, remember that V is epsilon, so we expect to have a power of 1 over epsilon, because it's the power of 1 over V that we had before, times another piece here. But notice that this guy here has a square root of epsilon. Now, we, as I said before, the expansion of this H does not contain any half-integer powers of epsilon, or V. It just contains integer powers of V, or equivalently or of epsilon. Then what we need to say that this guy here, when you replace AJ with this expansion and gamma J with this expansion, is nothing but this integral here, this integral has to vanish. Because there is no such a term on the right-hand side. How do we obtain that? So as you see, we have a polynomial here of log J square over epsilon times an elliptic function. Since the elliptic function is kernel zero, it's enough to say that this polynomial here has to be zero. Now, what we obtain here, we obtain some relation for this coefficient here. Notice one thing first, that this is true at any loop in perturbation theory, because the dependence on the loop order is encoded in P1, Q1, and so on. This just emits an expansion in all loops. The second thing that I want to notice is the fact that I can trust this expansion, so the only thing that I can say that I don't want this kind of divergence. But now, what I've been able to fix, I've been able to fix P1 and Q1. So let's go back here. I fixed P1 and Q1, yes. So P1 and Q1. So now I can say, okay, my talk is finished. I fixed these two terms and that's it. Because I ended all my divergences. I don't have any divergence anymore from here. I only have these two terms. But of course, this is not true. You can see that I have many more slides. So there is a way out of this problem. And what is the way out? What we can do, we can apply, as I said, the conformal block is an eigenfunction of the Casimir operator. So what I can do, I can apply the Casimir operator on both sides of my equation. When I apply the Casimir operator, what I do, if you remember the eigenvalue of the Casimir. The eigenvalue of the Casimir is J square over epsilon. So it just brings down, when I hit with my second order differential equation, it just gives me a power of J square over epsilon. And then I will explore more orders in the expansion, because now I bring down a divergence of 1 over epsilon, and I can go and explore the next term. Then I will hit with the Casimir again, and so on. I can do this infinitely many times. Another thing that maybe is not obvious, but is the fact that the action of the Casimir operator will not influence the fact that all the integers power of V appear. It's pretty easy to understand why. So this is a second order differential operator which depends only on powers of V, on integer powers of V. It hits on something which is a polynomial, so cannot give anything else that, again, integer powers of V. Cannot give a VO to the power 3 over 2, for instance. And what, so after doing these things, you can start seeing a pattern, and the pattern is just this. So the large J expansion of the anomalous dimension as a function of this J before, and of this weird combination, so this is my rescale three-point function, and this is this combination here, contains only even powers of J. So this resembles very much the reciprocity principle. For the reciprocity principle, what we had that this function F could be expanded only in even powers of this JB, and what happens here is essentially the same. But now what we gained a reciprocity principle for structure constants. So now there is the same statement holds for this combination here. So if you take this combination again and you think as this three-point function as a function of J, this contains only even powers of J. Now we can consider, so what I said, let me stress another time, that this is true at any order in perturbation theory, because I don't need to specify the order of perturbation theory. Now what I can also study non-perturbative conformal field theories. For the non-perturbative conformal field theories, what I can do, I can start again by the four-point function of four identical scalar operator with of some dimension delta O. I can study again the operator product expansion of this of such operator, and in this operator product expansion, it appears an operator which has some twist tau min, which is the minimal twist. So there will be an infinite tower of operators, and there is an operator with lowest twist, which is tau min. Then, again, I can consider, okay, this I don't have time to explain, but if we use crossing symmetry, this implies the existence of a tower of double trace operator which has this twist here. So now, what you can see from here, you can see that you don't have any log dependence before this gamma was as a logarithmic dependence for large L. In this case, you have this C over L to the tau min. And again, what I want to study this dot, dot, dot here. What I do exactly what I did in the previous case. So I introduce the rescale Casimir. Now everything, of course, will depend on this dimension here. And so this is what I already said. Let me skip it. So, well, for tau min equal to 2, for instance, what we can do, we can write gamma L and AL in this form, so we can expand everything in terms of this J square in this form. We can exactly go through the same steps that I did in the perturbative case, and again we end up with the same conclusion. Namely, that the anomalous dimension for large J contains only even powers of 1 over J, and the expansion of this guy, again, contains only even powers of 1 over J. Now, what we did, we checked several examples to see if this was really true. So actually, what I said, it seems to be a bit specific, but this is not true. I just put it in a specific form in order to present and to make the notation not very heavy. But this is true for any minimal twist. So what I said in the perturbative case, I set the twist to be 2, but this works for any twist. And also in this case, this is valid for any tau min. This is much more general of what I presented, but I just chose this specific way of in order to present it a bit better. So we checked these examples. So we checked n equal 4 super Yamils, because we have many data. Of course, the point is that now you need data. You need perturbative computation in order to check. Otherwise, you cannot check anything. So we choose n equal 4 super Yamils, and we check this proposal for the anomalous dimension up to 3 loops, and for the 3-point function up to 3 loops, because these are the data which are known. Then we checked also n equal 0, 1, 2 super Yamils, up to 2 loops, the anomalous dimension, but there is no computation of the 3-point coupling. Now you can be a bit surprised and say that I need to go back and do my study in physics because QCD is non-conformal. So what I said is just for conformal, what I use just conformal field theories. But actually one can also study some operators in QCD by taking into account the fact that the beta function is non-zero. So I can take into account this fact and I can do exactly the same way by using dimensional regularization essentially. So I can study my theory instead of studying it in four dimension, I can study in 4 - 2 epsilon dimension, and then I can go through. I don't have time to explain that, but this is a very well-known fact. And we checked those in this case, and then, so, these three, first three are perturbative, the last two are non-perturbative, so we checked n equal 4 at large n, and we check also some ON critical models. So as you see, we don't have many checks for OP coefficient, because in general, are much more harder to compute by using Feynman diagrams. So people didn't really compute this object. Actually, in QCD, I don't even know exactly which kind of meanings they have, but I think they are these Wilson coefficients. The point is that when you do some non-conformal field theories, they start depending on the scheme that you choose. So, a bit of a mess in this QCD example. But let me wrap up. So, what I presented to you today is a way of getting infinite number of constraints on the large spin expansion of the anomalous dimension and of the OP coefficient. And this approach that I used is not based on a Feynman diagram or on the form of perturbation theory, but is based on generic properties of CFTs and on symmetries such as analyticity, unitarity, crossing symmetry. I didn't explain it you well, but for the non-perturbative case you need it, and the structure of the conformal partial wave or the operator product expansion. So everything that I said is true for any leading twist operator, meaning is true if the leading twist operator has twist 3, is valid for this operator at twist 3, and so on. And they don't rely on any planar limit, and they are valid at any loop order in perturbation theory. So this is valid a bit generic. So what we can do, I think this point is a bit interesting, in the sense that what we derived some set of constraints for 3-point functions. Now, it's very complicated, as I said, to compute 3-point functions. So what we can hope that this kind of relation are of help in computing, or at least constraining 3-point functions in conformal field theories, which is essentially what happened in the case of the reciprocity principle for anomalous dimension. Another thing is that do we have any hope of checking our prediction for OP coefficient in the case of QCD? Also in this case it would be nice because it will, since, as I said, these Wilson coefficients are hard to compute, we can use this kind of structure in order to predict some property of this coefficient here. Okay, thank you very much for the attention.
Okay, thank you very much for your talk. And we have time for questions.
I don't see them.
You said you checked in QCD this perturbatively?
Mm-hmm. Indeed, for this operator, this transfer distribution.
This is different from the analysis what was already done by Kuchemski.
No. This is just, I think, the only different thing of what they did is for n equal 4, because there were less loop known. So I think the check was at 2 loops for... But no, I'm saying... Yes, it was at 2
QCD
loops,
then.
Because this... No, QCD was just what he did, because there is nothing new.
And so you confirm that there is a scheme dependence in this analysis?
Yes.
It's not really... Okay.
Yeah, there is a scheme. But I think it's expected to... you expect to have scheme dependence because at least in our case it's very easy to see because you get the beta function. And the computation of the beta function depends on the scheme that you choose.
Sure. I mean, just to say that this destroys a little bit the beauty of the thing.
Yeah, but what is nice, I think, is that if you choose the same scheme, you can compute also the same for the Wilson coefficient. So if you pick up a scheme that you like, or the scheme that this guy computed for two loops, which I think is, I don't remember the name, but it's this minimal scheme, you can choose the same and hope to say something about this A in this specific scheme. Yes.
Question about false polynomials. Mm-hmm. I think by integrability, those anomalous dimensions are known to our order.
Yeah, so sure.
What's the reason you stop at three loops?
Because this is what we did. We checked the full thing, non-planar and non-planar. We just stopped. So this is the full one. This is the non-planar part, in the sense that the one that contains all the 1 over n things. Because in order to do non-planar, you need also to play with the coupling constant. This is general in full.
Okay.
This is true in general. So we stopped at three loops because this is the highest loop order in which you know the full anomalous dimension as a function also in the rank of the gauge group, not only in the planar limit.
So before we, as I don't see any further questions, before we thank the speaker again,